thank you for joining me on this episode of The Gospel Truth. I'm your host, Marla Wilson, and once again, we have another great show today. I have a great guest on. Many of us know him in the Christian community. Dr. Gary Habermas is joining me. He is a professor at Liberty University, and I'm just excited. I reached out to him a couple weeks ago, and he decided to come on, so I'm super excited for him to be here. But before we get to the interview, I do want to go ahead and remind you of the upcoming shows that I do have coming up. August 2nd, I have Sam Shamoon coming on at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and we'll be discussing Islam. Also, have August 9th, I have Garen Scheider coming on, and we'll be talking about Black Hebrew Israelites and his testimony of how he left the Black Hebrew Israelite worldview. August 12th, we'll have another debate, James D. Martin versus Nazam Ghaffar, who is a Muslim, and they'll be discussing or debating the divinity of Christ. And on August 20th at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, I'll have Ricky Roden on versus Jerry Julev, another debate, and they'll be discussing does the God of the Bible exist. So I have a whole bunch of shows. This is just the first half of all the shows that I have coming on. I have shows all the way up to November. So just keep your eyes and ears open for those upcoming shows, and we'll get that going for you guys. With that said, I do want to introduce my guest. He is on a short time, so I really want to get him on. Dr. Gary Habermas is a distinguished professor of apologetics and philosophy and the chairman of the Department of Philosophy and Theology at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. He holds a PhD from Michigan State University in the area of history and philosophy of religion, and a master's of art from University of Detroit in philosophical theology. He has specialized in cataloging and communicating trends among scholars in the field of historical Jesus and New Testament studies. Habermas has authored and co-authored 35 books on religious and philosophical subjects, contributed to over 60 chapters of articles and books, and published over 100 articles in review and peer-reviewed journals. He continues to do research, publish popular and academic papers, give debates, and frequently appears on TV. And let me bring in Dr. Gary Habermas. How you doing, doctor? How's it going?
I'm doing well, Marlon. How about you?
Doing good. I'm glad you was able to join me. I do appreciate your time. So we want to get this interview going because I know you are pressed for time. So I definitely appreciate you coming on and devote some of that time to my show. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. So today, you know, the shroud, the Turin shroud, I really want to get into that, and we want to talk about the evidence for the resurrection. So before we go into that, what are some of the current things that you have going on within your ministry right now?
Well, I only teach at the PhD level, so I teach three classes a year, and that's full time. I'm a chair of a department and teach a PhD requires more prep. So I teach a spring, summer, and fall course for the PhD program in theology and apologetics. And all I'm on the road speaking. I've been gone for 4 weeks this summer. And I write. I'm in the middle of a magnum opus on the resurrection. And I am currently, believe it or not, I type with two fingers, and I have 4,400 pages in that manuscript.
Incredible. Wow. Incredible. You type with two fingers. I used to type that same way, man. I'm getting a little better now since I was doing online classes and everything. I had to type a little faster, but I'm getting a little better now. I get a little better. So that's cool. That's cool, doctor. Once again, I do appreciate you. And as I always tell my guests, I'm praying for you. I'm praying for your ministry and everything. And everything you're doing. You've been doing this for so long. You know, I can only imagine the wealth of knowledge that you have and the how God has blessed you to be able to minister to so many people throughout your years, I remember your testimony, sharing your testimony, and just the books that you co-authored, like Mike Lacona, you know, and the risen Jesus and the Future Hope. I have that book of yours, and it's amazing. And I just want to encourage you to continue to do what you do, and we're praying for your ministry and everything.
I appreciate it. I really do.
All right. So, the shroud. So what is it about the Turin shroud that is so fascinating?
Great question. I'm sure a combination of things. Number one, there are many burial garments in existence, but of the hundreds of burial garments in existence, the Shroud of Turin is the only one with a body image. I mean, most of the cloths, if they have anything on them, like in museums, they are, let's say, blood or decomposition, but the Shroud is the only one with a body image on them. And that's amazing. Okay, let's just start there. There's a body image. Number two, the person in the Shroud is crucified and has basically all the marks that Jesus had. Now, that's strange because the crucifixion of Jesus is not a normal crucifixion. It's not a normal crucifixion at all. And so, but the man in the Shroud has the same one. And then lastly, it's body image, number two, man is like number three, it appears that radiation is coming from the dead body. It seems like the major theory is there's an image on the cloth from radiation. Now, what's a dead body doing giving off radiation? Mm-hmm. It's because it's scientifically examinable. I think all of that together is why there's so much interest in Shroud.
Okay. Yeah, because I know you talked about a little bit in your book, The Risen Jesus and the Future Hope, and also you spoke about it. I watched a couple of videos of yours as well describing the turn. I also saw, I think, a video on or a show on the History Channel, and it was talking about it briefly about the Shroud of Turin. And so it's always been interesting. I'm like looking at it and I'm interested. You know, always these kind of things, always sometimes, you know, even within the Christian fall, sometimes people, they sign it off as a folk tale or false, you know, or something, another religious, I guess something worthy of idol worship or something like that. So people are naturally afraid to study it, to embrace it, or whatever it is as evidence for the resurrection. Yeah. So what is the history behind the Shroud? And that's the question. What is the history behind the Shroud? Where does the dating process of the Shroud, if that makes sense, if that question makes sense?
Well, I'll tell you what, before I answer that, one comment you said, and rightly so, that a lot of people distrust the Shroud, a lot of Christians, because they think it's like a graven image or something. One of the major Shroud scholars is a Jewish photographer for the Shroud team, and his name is Barry Schwartz. He's very well known. He is the owner of the website shroud.com, which is probably the best Shroud website in the world. And Barry said in an article, made a lot of sense. He said, let's think about this. In Jewish circles, and he's Jewish, he said in Jewish circles, graven images are things you make. That's graven image means you make it. But nobody can make the Shroud. It's not a fake. Mm-hmm. So his argument is whatever the Shroud is, it's not a graven image. It's a real object. So that might change that. As far as history, nobody's sure, but the leading theory is that the Shroud was moved out of Israel about 30 AD, if it's authentic, and taken up to Turkey. And it was in Turkey, more than one place, for hundreds of years, and then taken up to Western Europe during the Crusades. And it's remained in Western Europe, mostly Italy, for, since about the beginning of the Renaissance. So it's been in Western Europe for its modern history.
Okay, cool. So also, there were 3D images that were taken of the Shroud. And how does that shed extra light on the authenticity of the Shroud and the position of the body, if you will, when we're talking about the 3D images of the Shroud?
Now, what do you mean three images?
3D images of the Shroud. I know they took...
Oh, 3D.
Yeah.
3D,
yeah,
I know, I missed
that. Yeah.
3D, until recently, And some would say it's still the case. But until recently, 3D was the most difficult thing to explain from a natural viewpoint. Now, here's the point. What's a 3D image? The shroud, the image shroud is three-dimensional. It has cloth to body distance. It tells you, the 3D image can tell you how close the cloth came to the body in a bunch of different areas. And so if the cloth is resting right on the body, most obviously the blood stains are going to be transferred to the cloth because they're wet and they're going to sink through the cloth. But the rest of the image is only on the top fibrils. If you can picture a thread with maybe 200 fibrils, the shroud image is only the top one or two fibrils on the shroud. So 3D measures cloth to body distance, and frankly, there's nothing like it. There are no 3D images on any burial cloth, but you can't even get 3D images. They can't fake it in a laboratory.
That's interesting, because that's really interesting, because I think, if I remember correctly, it had to do with the leg position. Like, you can see, as you do the 3D image of the shroud, you can see the leg positioning and how the leg positioning was anchored up as if it was right. it was sitting on top of one another or something like that, and you can see how the arms are crossed over each other. Right. So I thought that was pretty interesting when I was looking at that.
Yeah, that's the point. For example, you mentioned the leg. The left leg is popped up because the body's in a state of rigor mortis. Mm-hmm. So when you're on the cross, your legs are bent. Your knees are usually bent. And the left leg is popped up into that where the knee kind of pops up. But the right leg is lower. But now the question is, how are the legs equally represented on the cloth, but one was touching and the other one, the shroud was not laying up against it in the same way? So 3D means the image kind of jumped through space. And now when you say the image jumps through space and makes a clear image, that's a whole new ball game.
Yeah, definitely. Another critique, I guess, skeptics has made about it is that the man that's portrayed in the shroud, it appears that he's been right. pierced through his wrist instead of his hand. So a lot of people make the argument that, well, the Bible right. says that that Jesus Christ was pierced through his hands. So what do we make of the man in the shroud that's pierced through his wrist? How do we clear that one up?
People who say he was nailed in the hands and not on the wrist, I don't want to be pejorative, but I think it's people who don't read Greek,
okay.
by and large, because the Greek word "hand" is not very specific. And it has been used for other parts on the arm. It's not real specific. I don't know this about Greek. I don't know, how the differences between modern Greek and Koine, New Testament Greek. But I had a lady from Greece tell me one time, there's no word for wrist in Greek. I don't know about that. But the word that's translated, hand can mean movement up and down the hand and the lower arm. So it's not very specific. Most New Testament scholars, as far as I know, majority of New Testament scholars believe the nails were actually placed in the wrist.
Okay. Because that was one thing for me when I read that I was like, hold on. Does not the Bible say that he was pierced through his hand? So I had to really go back and go over that right. and try to hash that one out. And like I said, I saw your video and you were talking. It was, I think the video that I watched you explain that portion was, I think the video was like an hour long. And you went over some of the evidences for the shroud, for the Turin shroud, and things like that. And you explained that, and I was like, okay, that's good clarification, because that definitely was a stopping point for me to try to understand, like, hey, how do we close this gap up? So I do appreciate you for that.
The hands problem is not an issue whatsoever. Not with New Testament scholars. There's just no hang up at that point at all. Maybe a layperson who has always been taught, or, you know, the medieval paintings. That's another thing. That's an evidence shroud. The medieval paintings, I understand from an art historian who did a report, medieval paintings always show the nails in the palms in medieval art. But the shroud, if it was trying to copy medieval practice and make money off of fake cloth, why in the world are you doing anything so silly as moving the nail holes to the wrist? If you're trying to make people in the medieval times thinking they're looking at Jesus, for crying out, the nail holes in his palm where all the art has it. Nope, it's in his wrist. So that's one more indication that the shroud is authentic.
Cool. So what do you say to those who still doubt the shroud, with all the evidence that we have, all the evidence pointed that shows a high probability that could probably be Christ in that shroud? What would you say to those who still doubt it, who still don't have the confidence in it?
Yeah. Well, if they don't have confidence in it, you know, there are anybody can think of good questions. So if they just have questions about the shroud, that's absolutely fine. But I think if you have questions about the shroud, you should check them against the evidence and see which ones are really good questions. I don't doubt that some people could have good questions. I'm just saying, make sure your questions are good questions and not questions that are easily answered and aren't really what the shroud is.
Okay. Sounds good, doctor. So I do want to transition to the resurrection. So as you know, there are many naturalistic theories for trying to discredit the resurrection. One is hallucination, right? So why is it that hallucination, the argument for hallucination, is not a good argument for evidence against the resurrection?
It's really interesting that you're asking me this question, Marlon, because I comment at the start of the show that I'm doing a manuscript that could end up as long as 5,000 pages on the resurrection. Mm-hmm. And I am currently, this minute, this week, doing a chapter on hallucinations.
Oh, wow.
So that's the chapter I'm working on. There are different expressions of hallucinations. There's probably four or five ways you can go on it. So I had to slow down and critique all four or five ways. But I have I'd have to go back and look at my chapter, but I have like 30 refutations. So it depends on what you want to go to. Here's a couple for you.
Okay.
Hallucinations. I ask my PhD students, I'll say, is the hallucination theory, is it an empty tomb theory or is it a closed theory? And they'll say, well, it's a closed tomb theory, because if the disciples saw hallucinations, guess what? The body's still in the tomb. But we have over 20 arguments for the historicity of an empty tomb. Over 20 arguments. And if there's over 20 arguments for the historicity of the empty tomb, that's a big problem. So someone goes, well, somebody could have stolen the body. Right, but you're doing hallucination theory. So now if you got to have a stolen body theory, now you got two theories proved. That's a big problem. Another one is the hallucinations theory cannot answer group appearances. Critics have tried really hard to play with group appearances or explanations, but they have not been successful. And the fact that our earliest evidence for the resurrection, going back, critics think, to within a year or two after the cross, the earliest explanation, 1 Corinthians 15, 3-7, which critics accept, atheistic and agnostic and skeptical New Testament scholars accepted, There are three group appearances in that list. And so hallucinations, those are two of the most difficult problems. What do you do with the empty tomb? And especially what do you do with group appearances?
Yeah, also, but they also make the argument that Paul the Apostle was hallucinating. So when he's on his road to Damascus, right? Don't they argue that Paul the Apostle was also hallucinating and that he might have, that his experience was nothing more than a hallucination of sorts?
Okay, now Marlon, here's my response to that. Anybody can say to, but what's the evidence that Paul hallucinating? If they're going to ask me for evidence, I get to ask them for evidence. Mm-hmm. And I want to know, how do you know Paul was hallucinating? And they will often say, well, he was probably through grief because he killed all these Christians and probably feeling real badly. But guess what? No source says that. You can surmise that. You can make it up. You can say, I would feel badly if I killed people, but you're not Paul. So how do you know Paul felt badly? Paul, in the two passages that he talks at length, Galatians chapter 1, Philippians chapter 3, and critics always tell you that those are authentic Pauline chapters and books, but Paul says he was excited. He was exuberant. He was being above his peers in his age group, and he thought he was doing God a favor by imprisoning or watching Christians like Stephen be killed. Paul gives no evidence of being depressed or whatever. So people who say that, here's my question. How come I have to give you evidence, but you don't have to give me any evidence? Mm-hmm. Paul does not look like anybody close to having an hallucination because he didn't want to see Jesus. He didn't believe in Jesus. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that you know, Paul's conversion, Paul's conversion is confirmation of the fact that I would say that the resurrection is absolutely real. You know what I mean? Because as Jesus Christ appeared to Paul, and the way his conversion happened, and the radicalness of his conversion, I think that points to the evidence that the resurrection was absolutely real. And I think most scholars would agree. Wouldn't you say that?
I think most, some scholars who are atheists, mm-hmm. atheist New Testament scholars and atheist non-New Testament scholars, they will say Paul's resurrection appearance is an eyewitness appearance. He is giving you a report of his own experience, of what he believed he saw. So they take Paul, skeptics take Paul very seriously.
Mm. Mm, yeah, I know Bart Ehrman. You got your guy like Bart Ehrman, who is I would consider him probably I don't know. I guess the term, he's super critical of history. I mean, I had a conversation with Mike Lacona. I'm not sure if I shared that with you, but I had Mike Lacona on my show as well. I had him on maybe a couple months ago, and we were talking about his debate with Bart Ehrman and how Bart Ehrman discredits even the historicity of the biblical text. He discredits numerous things. And I'm like, how does somebody who has such a high level of criticalness towards history, how can he even conclude the simple things? You know, when when we're dealing with individuals of that nature, you know, how as a scholar, how as a New Testament scholar, how as a someone who studied this for years, you know, how do you deal with individuals such as that, Doctor?
Well, Mike Lacona would be the guy to ask, because he's had several dialogues, written and oral, with Bart Ehrman. But I can tell you this, Bart Ehrman respects history a lot, and he has admitted he's mentioned two really crucial areas of evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. One is, he says there are 15 independent source prediction of Jesus within 100 years of his birth. Now, the way he goes 100 years, Ehrman thinks anything up to 100 years in the ancient world is pretty potentially reliable. And we have 15 different sources for the crucifixion. Secondly, he says we have a handful of early creedal reports that date from just 1 to 2 years after the cross and record the disciples' belief that they saw the resurrection. Now, of course, Barterman's an atheist. He doesn't believe the disciples actually saw the risen Jesus, but he believes the disciples thought they saw the risen. And he said, I'm not going to argue with that because it's a proven fact of history. And that's very close to his own words. So he gives a lot of ground that has to be considered, but he is a New Testament scholar.
Yeah, I also know Muslims, they tend to use Bart Ehrman's arguments. You know, they love to parrot Bart Ehrman's arguments, you know. So, the situation is compounded when we have that issue as well. But I don't think Muslims take in consideration that Bart Ehrman actually gives some historical credit, you know what I mean, to the biblical text, you know what I mean? Especially when it's considering the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, he didn't believe in the resurrection, but a lot of surrounding data. Yes.
Yeah, definitely. So in your book, The Risen Christ, you talk about the six facts, the six minimal facts. So you mind espousing that a little bit about the six minimal facts?
Sure. I did this way back to my doctoral dissertation at Michigan State in the 1970s. I mean, that sounds like the Middle Ages, doesn't it? but I back in my dissertation, you don't have to have everything in the New Testament. I mean, I believe we have everything in the New Testament, but you don't need everything to prove the resurrection. If we take only, and I use different facts because nobody only gives me this few, but if you take only a dozen key facts, you can show the resurrection is the best section from those half dozen facts alone. And the half dozen facts that I would use include the following. Jesus died by crucifixion. He afterwards, okay, so he's dead. Afterwards, too, the disciples had experiences that they believed were appearances of the risen Jesus. So the disciples thought they saw Jesus. That plain and simple. They thought they saw Jesus. Barterman admits that. Number three, their lives were transformed, totally transformed, to the point where they're willing to die. Now, I stop there because a lot of people say, well, everyone's willing to die. All you got to do is be really, really seriously committed to a fact. And there's many missionaries of many faiths, and they're willing to die, you know, for what they believe is true. Okay, but here's the difference. Today, missionaries in different religions die for what they believe to be a fact. The disciples are the only ones of all the groups we're talking about. The disciples are the only groups who, even as Bart Ehrman says, thought they saw the risen. With us today, missionaries are responding to a belief, but the disciples are responding to something they saw, and it's totally different. Mm-hmm. So number three, they were transformed because they thought they saw Jesus. Four, they proclaimed the resurrection very early. How early? Well, I'll just cite Bart Ehrman again. Bart Ehrman thinks we have a half dozen sources that report the disciples thought they saw the risen Jesus from just 1 to 2 years after the cross. Just a mere 1 to 2 years after the cross. And the last two are James and Paul make six. And I count them separately because James and Paul are skeptics, but they're very different skeptics. James is a family member. Paul is somebody who locked Christians up and helped Christians be killed, as in the case of Stephen. He held the coats, it says, while the people stoned Stephen. He was there while these things happened. And so they're different. So those are my six. We have Jesus died by crucifixion. The disciples thought they saw him again. Their lives were totally transformed, not by their mere belief in the resurrection, but by their believing they saw the resurrection. Four, it's proclaimed very early, right after the cross, and five and six, Paul.
Hi, thank you for joining me on this episode of the Gospel Truth. I pray that you're enjoying it. I just want to take time to tell you about two things. One, if you wonder how you can get on this show for a debate, just go ahead and message me in my inbox. The only requirement is that you, at the very least, have to be a Christian. Whether it's another Christian you want to debate, whether it's an atheist you want to debate, or whether it's somebody from another worldview religion that you want to debate. Secondly, if you ever wonder how you can support this ministry, The Gospel Truth, just flow up to the top of the Facebook page, The Gospel Truth, and look at the video that's pinned to the top of the page, and you'll see the Patreon link to go ahead and support this ministry. The link is www.patreon.com/The Gospel Truth. Once again, I want to thank you for joining me in this episode, and I pray this episode will be a blessing. God bless. We love you over here. Thank you. Bye.
And 5 and 6, Paul and James. And I will add this, Marlon. It's not part of my 6 minimal facts, but the empty tomb deserves a lot of attention here, too. There are over 20 historical evidences, according to critics, there are over 20 strong historical evidences for the empty tomb. So you put all those together, what I call 6 plus 1, 6 minimal facts plus the empty tomb, and we've got a strong case for the resurrection.
Oh, wow. You know, it's always amazing to me when we're considering the historicity, you know, of the biblical text and things like that. I guess one of my issues is that, and I know, you know, dealing with skeptics, dealing with atheists, you know, they don't see the Bible as historical documents. You know what I mean? Like some scholars do. I'm not gonna say all skeptics, but a lot of scholars do see the biblical text in its original form, manuscript evidence, things like that. It's historical evidence, but they discount the miracle aspects of the contents of those manuscripts. Through your years, I'm sure you've encountered it. How do you surmise, and how do you get someone to realize their error if they're willing to accept the historical basis for a particular text, the biblical text, but yet reject the miracle aspect of the same text that they actually just gave credit to? Like, how do you, from an apologetic perspective, what are some responses that you can give in order to sort of, you know, have them realize, like, hey, they're sort of contradicting themselves in a way?
Well, here's a bunch of them. One critic says, I don't believe in the supernatural. If you have good arguments for God, that changes everything. Believe in God, but if you have good arguments for God, that changes everything, and you can argue from belief in God to the resurrection. That's one approach. What about God? And there you can talk about the Kalam argument. You can talk about intelligent design. Going to God is one option. Mm-hmm. Another option is that critics today, when I went to graduate school in the 70s, the view that Jesus did miracles, not the resurrection, but that Jesus healed people, and so on. That view was a minority view. It was a real minority view. Critics didn't believe that. Today, I have read critics who say 100% of critics believe Jesus is a worker. And I don't think that's 100%. But they say that. They'll say all critics today believe Jesus is a miracle worker. Okay, that's a second argument. If Jesus did miracles, you have to be open to his resurrection.
Yeah,
third argument, near-death experiences. If near-death experiences happened in the world as another world. If people had, in a recent survey, Marlon, a medical survey published by a state university, not a popular, you know, press, in a medical survey, one of the latest books said that in Europe and North America alone, up to 30 million people have claimed near-death experiences and near-death phenomena. And I just did a written debate, and there are 300 evidential cases where people see things, death experiences, that they could not have seen even being totally alive. But as far as we know from the machines, they got brain flat heart. NDEs, near-death experience, I think is a very strong argument. I think intelligent design is a strong argument. Those are all the supernatural world. And if there's a supernatural world, there's no way you can rule out miracles by saying you don't believe them. If you want others, what about the shroud? We talked about the shroud. The shroud of Jesus' burial garment, then you better have a good look at the resurrection. So there's four or five responses right there that open up the supernatural world to our research.
Okay. Yeah, because I guess when we're talking about, so we also remember David Hume's argument, and a lot of philosophers, a lot of secular philosophers, they tend to try to use David Hume's argument to try to refute the idea of miracles. If I'm not mistaken, I believe David Hume's argument is that miracles are impossible because they infiltrate the natural world. They disrupt the natural world, the natural flow of things. So therefore, miracles are impossible. I might be paraphrasing his argument a little bit, but I think that's the pretty much the sum of it.
Yeah, well, today, I can give details if you want to go there, but it's really technical. First of all, on what David Hume's argument was, there are, if you just ask only critics, on exactly what David Hume was trying to argue. So David Hume could be taken three, four ways. But here's the problem. In recent journal treatments of David Hume over the last 30 years, David Hume was taking a hit. Hmm. In fact, maybe the major Hume critic in the last couple of decades is a skeptic. If I'm mistaken, he's a naturalist. Hmm. He definitely is not a Christian. He definitely doesn't, as far as I know, doesn't believe anything supernatural. But one thing he does believe is that David Hume is wrong. And a lot of people don't know this, but even while David Hume was alive, he got in a debate with a very well-known and well-trained pastor in the 18th century, and David Hume actually said, you can print, David Hume actually said that this pastor beat me in a debate. He got the best of me. So I guess I'm saying two things. There are a bunch of ways to take David Hume, and critics today think any way you try to take Hume, his argument doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and I would like to think that, you know, a lot of our atheist friends would, you know, take that in consideration and realize that these arguments against God just simply don't hold water. They just simply don't stand up to critical analysis. They just simply don't stand. And they will consider these things, but it seems that I would say that there's a condition with the heart. You know what I mean? As you know, there's a condition with the heart, you know, and God needs to transform that heart, you know, in order to see that special revelation of Christ. So, you know, obviously we've talked about numerous subjects, you know, a couple, you know, talk about the shroud, evidence for the shroud, talk about philosophical arguments, but there's one last question I have for you, Dr. Hume. I called you Dr. Hume, thinking about Dr. Hume, but Dr. Habermas, I have one more question for you, Dr. Habermas, and it's probably the most important question that we've talked about so far, that we're going to be talking about. So what is the gospel truth? What is the concrete message of the gospel of Jesus Christ?
Okay, great question. Marlon, before I answer the question, let me make one comment about your very insightful statement that most people who disbelieve miracles, it's a problem with the heart and not a problem with evidence. Mm-hmm. According to actual general surveys of people and also psychological of non-Christian psychological articles about belief, and from those studies, the majority of people who don't believe things, in this case Christianity, the majority of people don't disbelieve because the evidence is bad. They misbelieve because they don't want it. Mm. And the story I tell is, if you and I were absolute best friends, and I was married and you were single, but we're buddies, and I want you to understand how blessed marriage is. So I want to introduce you to a woman who I know and you don't. And I think she's the greatest, you know, I'm married, so I can't say greatest woman of the world. But in this little story, I think she's the next greatest woman I've ever met. And you're my buddy. So I want you to date her. I want you to see her so you can understand the joys of marriage, right? And you say to me, well, dude, I don't go out on blind dates, but because we're such good friends, all right, I'll try it. And you go out with her a few times and you come back and we talk again. And I say, so Marlon, what do you think? And you go, she is one neat lady. She is really, really neat. And I say, okay, man, we're best friends. Can I be your band at your wedding? And you go, in this little story again, you say, dude, look, she's probably the neatest lady I've ever met. Lips, I don't want to get married. There's a disconnect. There's no bridge between you're the neatest person I've ever met and I want to get married. People have a lot of friends who are the neatest people they ever met. And they don't get married. Okay, I think that's just like Christianity. People can, there's a number of skeptics today. I can give you names. There are a lot of skeptics today who will accept all six minimal facts. Mm-hmm. They'll accept all six minimal facts. And if I said to them, dude, we're best friends. When are you going to marry Jesus? Can I be your best man when you marry Jesus? Because I think in scripture, which I'll come back to the gospel question, it is an I do question. Mm-hmm. More about that in just a minute. But, and you say to me, well, I can't refute the six facts for Jesus, but I'm not ready to get married. And I'm not ready to say I do to Jesus. So to me, you are totally right with that little tiny story, best friends, and I'm going to introduce you to this lady. That little story, make-believe story, I think that's what happens with Jesus. They don't do it because they don't want to. It's that simple. Neat lady? Yes. Get married? No. Facts about Jesus? Yes. Get married to Jesus? No way. What is the gospel? Mm-hmm. Whenever the gospel is defined in the New Testament, it's chiefly Paul's epistles and the preaching in the book of Acts. Now, I'm not talking about when it uses the word gospel, but when the gospel is actually defined. And these three things are actually always present, if not always present. The deity, death, resurrection of Jesus. Deity, death, resurrection. And let me say something about those three. It's deity, death, resurrection, but they're the three facts concerning which we have the most on all three of those. Deity, death, resurrection, you can use only the data that critics accept, not just for the resurrection, but you can do the same thing for deity, same thing for death. We can show those three by facts that the critics admit. So I think it's a solid argument. Oh, there's two sides to the gospel, Marlon. As you know this. The first side is what's happened in history. And the gospel of the deity, death, and resurrection of Jesus is solid, solid, solid. But what has to be on top of that? The person has to be willing to get married. They've got to be willing to, in effect, be married to Jesus. Why do I say that? And somebody could say, it didn't say be married. It just says believe. Okay. You've got to go back and look at the Greek, the meaning of the Greek words for believe. The words are pistis, pistuo. These are the nouns for, these are the for believe, nouns too. But these are the words for believe. And the word is a very strong word. In Greek, believe, my Greek professor translate John 3:16 like this: for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever commits himself to him will not perish but have everlasting life. So Peter and John both say in the New Testament, are you willing to walk in his steps? So it's not, yeah, man, I believe the Yankees are the best team in baseball, or yeah, I believe George Washington was the first president of the United States. That's not New Testament belief. New Testament belief is, are you willing to get married? New Testament belief is, are you willing to say I do to Jesus? And that's where the rubber meets the road. Mm. Facts are powerful, but people don't want to marry Jesus.
Yeah, that, you know, and that's the God, and that's what you need. That's what you need, that power of the gospel, right? That power of the Holy Spirit to convict someone's heart, to change someone's heart, and to receiving salvation. And that's just the beauty of the gospel, the power of the gospel. So it's always interesting when I have conversations with people and I share evidences with someone, you know, and how they respond and how they react, you know, to those evidences, you know, and then when I go into my gospel presentation with that individual, you know, we keep an eye out on how they respond to the gospel, you know what I mean? So it's always fascinating. It's always interesting to see that, you know, so, the truth of the gospel, just continue to preach the truth of the gospel, continue to preach God, Jesus Christ, the living God, you know, resurrected on the third day with all power in his hands. And as a believer, you know, as Christians, all the work that you've done throughout the years, that is the center of all that we do, you know, and that's the center, is to make sure that the gospel is being proclaimed. And that his glory is being shown through the way we carry ourselves and the way we live our lives and things like that. That his glory is being shown, and that the truth of his gospel is real.
Yeah, and it's not enough for a person to say, "All right, you got me. I believe he's the Son of God. I believe he died on the cross for my sins. I believe he was raised from the dead. But I'm not going to say I do to him." That's like in my story. That's like my friend in my story, you, saying, "This is the neatest woman I've ever met, but I'm not going to say I do." Well, the gospel message are those three things. Hmm. But there's another part to it. Do you want to jump in with both feet? Do you want to say I do? When we say I do, we know that I do is a lifetime commitment. And for us guys, Marlon, I don't know. I do could involve changing diapers. I do could involve going shopping, you know, when I'm not crazy about going shopping, and vice versa. The wife's got to do things for the husband that she's not crazy about. What I'm saying is we're not all wanting to get in with both feet. And so I can't refute the evidence for the resurrection. But by the way, that's where a lot of the anger comes from that you mentioned. Because when critics are angry, it's like, all right, well, you got this gospel evidence, and I can't refute it, but you're telling me I can't go to heaven without doing that? And that makes them angry.
Yeah.
It sounds to them like you're making rules up.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people say, "Well, I didn't make those rules up. Those are Jesus's teaching."
Yeah.
What do you want to do with Jesus's teaching? You're going to have to come, "I believe Jesus." Hey, look, you're going in circles. You got to believe Jesus because Jesus was raised from the dead. Either refute the resurrection or believe in Jesus.
Yeah.
But you can't pick and choose. You can't say the resurrection is looking pretty good, but I don't want to get married. How dare he tell me that's the yellow brick road to the Emerald City? How dare I go, "I didn't tell you that. I'm my own authority. I'm repeating Jesus' words, and the man was raised from the dead. Do you want to follow raised from the dead, or do you want to follow your buddies who don't believe this stuff is true?" Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Anyway, so what comes from that, I think?
Mm-hmm.
I think what comes from that is anger.
So. Yeah, it's definitely, and once again, it's that sinful heart. It's that heart condition to where all that built up animosity towards God, for whatever reason, you know, whatever they went through in life, whatever came up in life through for them, you know, it's that built up animosity, enmity. The Bible refers to it as enmity, hostility towards God, you know, that sinful nature, you know, and it's just and once again, as believers, we are to exemplify what Christ has done in our hearts so that even the skeptic, even the enemy of God, will humble themselves and come through to the throne of grace.
That's correct. You did a job. It's a heart condition. Yes, it's about the evidence, but the evidence is really, really strong. Crossing the bridge and saying "I do" is the issue, because a lot of people don't want to be tied down to Jesus.
Amen. Amen.
That's very wise. You did a good job there.
Thank you, doctor. Thank you. Appreciate that. So that's all I have for you, doctor. I definitely appreciate you coming on the Gospel Truth, taking time out of your busy schedule. And When do you plan on releasing your new book, 5,000 page manuscript? When is that projected to be published and everything?
That's an issue. Listen, I'd like to see it published as much as anybody. It's killing me. Last week I worked 84 hours. I don't know. My goal is to finish writing it in about another year. That's my goal. Next summer. That's my goal. But then it's going to take me at least a year to do the editing.
Wow.
So, and then it's going to take them a year to bring it out in a book. It's probably still going to be 2 or 3 years. And guess what, Marlon? This is July.
Uh-huh.
2 months ago, May, I passed the 5-year mark working on this project.
Five years. Wow, that is a long time.
A long haul.
I was in school when you first.
Especially when you're working 70 hours a week.
Yeah, that's incredible. That is an incredible amount of devotion and patience, I would say. Oh man, that's a lot of work, doctor.
You said you interviewed Mike Lacona.
Yeah.
Mike is the one who said to me, Mike said, get working on this thing. He said, now just picture being told this. Mike said, get to work on this thing. You don't want to die and not leave that knowledge for the church. I'm thinking, well, Mike, I'm not planning to die real quickly. But he said, that's the point.
That's the point.
Yeah, man. So I'm getting that counting.
Yeah. It's all right, doctor.
So, all right, man. Good to see you.
All right, thanks, doctor. I appreciate you very much. Thank you so much.
All right.
Hey, doctor, what was that?
Let me know when your thing is posted.
Okay, I will.
And Marlon, if you would send me the URL when it gets published, send me the interview, and if you would give me in an email, if you give me permission to put it on my website, I'll put it up on my website too.
Okay, cool, doctor. I appreciate that. Definitely, I will.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, doctor. Appreciate it. Have a good day.
Have a great day.
All right.
All right, man.
All right, that is it from the Gospel Truth. That is it for today. Thank you once again for Dr. Habermas coming on and shedding some light on the evidence for the Turin Shroud and evidence for the resurrection. I do appreciate him coming on. So with that said, I want to go ahead and run through my shows that I have for today. August 2nd, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, I have Sam Shamoon on, and we'll be talking about Islam. August 9th, at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, I have Garen Scheider on, and we'll be talking about the Black Hebrew Israelites. August 12th, at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, I have a debate between James Martin and Nizam Ghaffar, and they'll be discussing or debating the deity or the divinity of Jesus Christ. And August 20th at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, I have another debate between Ricky Rodin and Jared Juloff. Does the God of the Bible exist? So I have a whole bunch of shows coming up. This is just in August, but I go beyond that. I have shows scheduled all the way up to the end of November. And it's just a lovely thing when people want to come on and discuss these important topics. So look out, look forward, subscribe, like, follow, everything you need to do to stay in tune with the Gospel Truth of what we have going on here. Once again, big thanks to Dr. Gary Habermas for coming on and shedding light on the evidence for the Turin Trial and evidence for the resurrection. It's always appreciated when I have individuals such as Dr. Gary Habermas, who's done so much for the Christian body, done so much work for the Christian body, and put so much energy to ensuring that the Christian body is supplied with the riches of knowledge that's needed in order to defend the faith, you know what I mean? To shed evidence for the faith, you know, to shed light on the fact that we have a reasonable faith, and it's not just something that just dismisses intelligence, you know, that intelligence is actually embraced because God has blessed us with logic and rationale to be able to embrace these things. and truth and knowledge comes from the Lord. It's a part of his nature. So it's always, I'm always thankful when they come on. With that said, the book giveaway is complete. And I will be announcing the winners of the book giveaway. I am giving away Christian Apologetics, Cornelius Van Til's Christian Apologetics. And I will be announcing the winners of that this coming, I believe, tomorrow. Or it'll be either tomorrow or it'll be September 1st or August 1st that I'll be announcing the winner of the book giveaway. But with that said, I want to thank you once again for joining me on this episode of The Gospel Truth. Go ahead and go to the YouTube page, subscribe, and cut on your notifications. Be sure to go through the videos and check out those videos. I have past debates and past interviews as well. So go ahead and go through that YouTube page and make sure that you subscribe and you cut on those notification bells whenever I go live. So you'll be notified when I go live and upload new content. Once again, blessings to you. And once again, I re-emphasize, I love to emphasize the gospel truth. The gospel is that Jesus Christ bled and died on the cross of Calvary, was buried for 3 days, and resurrected on the third day with all power in his hands, and that he died so that the wrath of God would be alleviated on those who believe. They will not have the weight of hostility from God towards the sinner. The weight of wrath will be lifted up, and that's why Jesus Christ died and was resurrected, so that we as believers and those who do come to believe will have the power of the resurrection, and they will be lived eternally with God in his kingdom. So that is the power and the truth of the resurrection. So if you are pondering Christ, if you feel God is tugging on your heart, repent of your sins, come to salvation. Don't wait another minute. Repent of your sins and humble yourself before the throne of grace. Once again, I thank you for joining me on The Gospel Truth. May God bless you and may God keep you. I am gone. God bless.